Fritz could fetch someone.
What, and miss my chance at the big time? Jim said. I'd like to think that all my years as a silent brother weren't totally pointless.
Livy was shrinking. Shrinking down almost to nothingness. All the darkness outside the glass walls of the conservatory was pressing in as if they were all submerged beneath Dimmitt Tarn. But she could still escape. She could be a living girl again. Jim got up and went over to Tessa. He knelt down in front of her and laid his head against her belly.
Hello there, Wilhelmina Yichanka Carstairs. Little Mina. You are welcome, little Mina, my heart. We are waiting for you in joy and hope and love.
Tessa rested her hand on Jem's head. I think she heard you, she said. I think she's hurrying now.
Livy, said the other voice. The one that Livy didn't want to hear right now. The one that tugged at her as if it were a leash. Livy, what are you doing? Something's wrong, Livy.
And oh, the voice was right. Livy came back to herself. What had she been thinking of doing? She had been going to... And as she realized what she had been about to do, all the walls of the conservatory exploded outward into the night in a great cloud of glass shards. Jem and Tessa both cried out, crouching down. And then Magnus was there, in green silk pajamas beautifully embroidered with Pokemon.
What in the world? He said, bending over to help Jem and Tessa up.
I don't know, Jem said wildly.
Demons? A sonic boom?
Magnus looked around the conservatory. A strange expression came over his face when he saw Livy.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to, Magnus.
Looking hard at her, Magnus said to Jem and Tessa,
Not a demon, I think. There's nothing dangerous here now. Come on, let's get you back to the house.
I have your herbs, Tessa. Kit's brewing you a nice cup of tea.
Oh, good, Tessa said faintly. The intervals between contractions are getting shorter. I thought there would be more time. Are you sure we shouldn't be more concerned about whatever broke all the windows?
Everyone always thinks they'll have more time, Magnus said.
He was still looking right at Livy as he said it. And no, I don't think you have to be concerned at all.
I would never let anything happen to you. Think of it as part of the christening. You know that when they christen a ship, they break a bottle of champagne against the forward bow. Your baby just gets the deluxe version. Imagine her voyage. Her life, I predict, will be full of wonders.
Come on, Jim said. Let's get inside the house. Magnus, will you bring my cello?
He took down his violin from the cabinet, and with his other hand he took Tessa's arm and began to walk her toward the house, over the dark ground strewn with broken glass.
Magnus said, Oh, Livy.
I almost, she said.
I know, he said. But you didn't. Go find Kit and stay with him. I'll come to you in a little while to fetch Tessa's tonic.
Kit seemed relieved, actually, to have company, even if company was only a ghost.
What happened out there? He said. What happened to the conservatory?
I think that was me, Livy said. I didn't mean to, though.
Is this the kind of thing that you've been getting up to at the Scholomance? Kit said. Is that why you came to find Magnus?
No, Livy said. I haven't done anything like this.
Well, not until today.
I think I smashed some plates at the Los Angeles Institute, and I made the lights go out in Drew's room while she was watching a scary movie.
Nice, Kit said. So like basic poltergeist stuff.
I didn't mean to do any of it, Livy said. It just sort of happened. I'm sorry I wrecked the conservatory.
Maybe you could try not to do anything like that again, Kit said.
Sure, Livy said. Of course, I don't want to do anything like that again. There was a glint off something Kit wore on a chain around his neck.
Oh, Livy said, looking closer. It was a heron made of silver.
It belonged to my mother, Kit said.
Jem and Tessa gave it to me a while ago. I found it again this morning. I'd forgotten about it.
It's so pretty, Livy said.
Kit said,
I'd give it to you if I could.
She used it to summon Jem and Tessa to her side when she was attacked. In the end, it didn't save her, so I guess I have a grudge against it.
Livy said, I'm sorry.
Why? Kit said. You didn't kill them. Anyway, everything's okay? He was looking at his hands very intently, as if he thought there might be something wrong with them.
What?
Livy said.
Yes, everything's fine.
Oh,
you mean Ty.
Kit didn't say anything, but he nodded. He looked as if he wished he hadn't asked at all, and also as if he were listening with all of his being. It was ridiculous, Livy thought. You could tell how much he missed Ty, as much as Ty missed him. She didn't understand boys at all. Why couldn't they just say what they felt? Why did they have to be so stupid?
He's okay, Livy said.
He's doing well at the Scholomance. He has a Carpathian lynx in his room. He doesn't really have any friends, though. He misses you. But he won't talk about it. But other than that, he's fine. As she said it, though, she realized that she wasn't sure at all that Ty was fine. The strand that bound her to Ty, the filament of magic, felt wrong, somehow as if it were slackening. She could feel Ty reaching for her, but weakly.
Livy, Kit said.
Oh no, she said. No, I think I have to go back. I think I shouldn't be here.
Now Kit looked truly alarmed. What's wrong? He said.
Ty, she said. It's hurting him that I'm here. Tell Magnus I'm sorry, but I have to go. Tell him to come find me. I have information for him about Idris.
About Idris? Kit said.
Never mind, I'll tell him. Go. And Livy went.
She must have been back at the Scholomance in the space of a breath, although to be fair, since she didn't breathe anymore, she was only guessing that's how long it took. She was in Ty's room, but Ty wasn't there. Only Irene, looking accusingly at her from the door, which she appeared to be attempting to chew open.
Sorry,
Livy said and then felt ridiculous. This time she let her awareness of Ty and where he was pull her toward him, and yet that was not where she found herself. She found herself instead hovering once more over Dimmitt Tarn.
No, she said, and feeling as if she were fighting her way to him through some impenetrable, gloomy, dark chasm, she came at last to her brother. He was lying in the bed in the infirmary, looking very pale. Katerina Loss was by his side, and a boy that Livy recognized from Ty's classes, Anush.
He just collapsed, Anush was saying. Is it food poisoning?
I don't think so,
Katerina Loss said.
I don't know.
Ty opened his eyes.
Livy,
he said, so softly that her name was barely a sound at all.
What did he say?
Anush asked.
Livy,
Katerina said, laying her hand on Ty's head.
His sister, the one who was slain by Annabelle Blackthorn.
Oh, Anush said. Oh, how sad,
Katerina Loss said.
His color is improving a little, I think. Are you good friends?
Not really, Anush said. I don't know who his friends are, if he has friends. I mean, he seems like a good guy, smart, super focused, but he kind of keeps to himself.
I'm going to keep him in the infirmary overnight,
Katerina Loss said.
But if it occurs to you to come back to visit him, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. Everyone needs friends.
Yeah, sure, Anush said. I'll come back later, see if he needs anything.
Katerina Loss poured a glass of water for Ty and helped him sit up to take a drink.
You fainted, she said in a neutral voice. Sometimes new students take their course of study too seriously and forget about things like getting enough sleep or eating.
I don't forget things like that, Ty said. I have a schedule so that I don't forget.
You came to me the other day about the lynx, Katerina Loss said. How is she doing? I see there are scratches on your arm.
She's great, Ty said. She eats everything I bring her, and she's drinking fine, too. How long have I been here? I should go make sure she's okay.
You've only been here a little while, Katerina Loss said. When Anush comes back, you can tell him to look after her for tonight. I think he'd be happy to do that. Do you think you could eat something?
Ty nodded and Katerina Loss said,
I'll see what delights the kitchen can supply. Stay in bed, I'll be right back.
When she was gone, Livy said, Ty.
Ty frowned at her.
He said, I could feel you getting farther and farther away. It hurt, Livy.
and you were getting stranger and stranger. The farther away you got, I could feel you. But you didn't feel like you anymore. You felt...
Livy said.
I know. I felt it too. It was scary, Ty. I was scary. You're going to have to write that down in your notebook. I don't think it's good when I'm away too long. I think the farther away from you I get, the more dangerous it is for both of us. The longer I stayed away, the more I forgot things. Like who I was, like you. Why I should come back.
Ty said. But you did come back.
I came back, Livy said. Almost too late, but I'm here now. And just in time. Irene is gnawing her way through your door.
She grinned at Ty reassuringly, and Ty smiled back, then his eyes closed again.
Ty, she said.
I'm fine, he said, just really tired. Going to sleep for a little while, Livy. Will you stay with me while I fall asleep?
Sure, she said, of course I will.
He was asleep when Katerina Loss returned with a tray of food, and still asleep when Magnus Bane came through the door several hours later in a puffy scarlet down parka, trimmed in black fake fur that came all the way down to his ankles. He looked as if he had been mostly swallowed by a big fat eiderdown dragon. Katerina Loss was with him.
A girl, she said. I've been knitting a blanket for her, but it isn't done yet. Wilhelmina Yuchanka Carstairs. That's quite a big name for a very small baby.
Mina for short, Magnus said.
Oh, she's lovely, Katerina. She has Jem's fingers, a musician's fingers, and Tessa's chin. So how's our patient?
He'll be fine, Katerina Loss said. Then, though what was wrong with him in the first place isn't quite apparent to me, he seems perfectly healthy. I'm due to teach a class. Will you still be here in an hour or so?
I'll be here or somewhere close at hand, Magnus said. Come and find me when you're done.
When Katerina Loss was gone, Magnus said to Livy,
Well, there is apparently something that you must say to me, and then there is something that I must say to you, Livy said.
I know. I think I know what you must say to me, but first let me tell you about Idris.
And she told him everything she had heard Zara and Manuel say.
We knew that sooner or later they planned to attack us, Magnus said at last. But now that we know they are spying on us, we will have to find out how. And perhaps if it's possible for them, then it's also possible for us to spy on Idris. But I don't think we can risk you doing it again.
No, Livy said. Because every time I get too far away from Ty, things start to go wrong. I start to change. I get stronger, I think. I can do things. Like I did with the conservatory. I broke dishes, too, and I think I almost hurt Tessa's baby somehow. And Ty, it's bad for him, too, when we're apart. That's why he ended up in the infirmary, because I was gone too long.
Yes, Magnus said. Smart girl.
If I had stayed away longer, Livy said, would he have died?
I don't know, Magnus said. But the magic he tried to use to bring you back from the dead was dark magic, Livy. Necromancy. A spell from the Black Volume of the Dead. And a failed spell at that. When the spell failed, the thing that kept you here, that bound you, was Ty. Your twin. That's not normal for ghosts. Most of them are bound to an object. Things like a ring or a key or a house. But you're bound to a person. It makes sense that you need to stay close to Ty now. And that he has to stay close to you. I think that when you're away from him for too long, you become less yourself. More powerful, less human. More a hungry ghost. Something dangerous to the living.
When I was in the conservatory, Livy said, forcing the words out, I felt as if I could swap places with Tessa's baby. That I could be alive again, if I were willing to take her baby's life, her baby's place.
Magnus said, Necromancy is a very dark art, yes. Perhaps you could have. Or perhaps you might have killed the baby or Tessa and ended up with nothing at all. Magic can have a high price, Livy.
I don't want to hurt anybody, Livy said. That's what Annabelle did. I don't want to be like Annabelle, Magnus. I don't.
but I don't want to be dead either. It isn't fair.
No, Magna said. It isn't fair. But life isn't fair. And you died bravely, Livy.
Stupidly, Livy said. I died stupidly.
Bravely, Magna said. Though I admit that sometimes I wish shadow hunters were a little less brave and used their heads a little more.
Livy sniffed. Well, she said, Ty is good at that, using his head.
Ty is exceptional, Magna said. I expect great things from him, and from you too, Livy. Because if you do not do great things, then I fear you may do terrible things. The two of you have remarkable potential.
Me? She said. But I'm dead.
Nevertheless, Magnus said. He reached into his pocket and said,
And I have a present for you.
Well, it's from Kit, too. It's for you and Ty. He held out a silver chain from which hung the figure of a bird. A heron, Livy realized. You're bound to Ty, Magnus said. But it's a necromantical bond. I was poking around for something to use that might work to bear a little of the weight that bond must be on you and Ty. And Kit asked what I was doing. He gave me this, and I have altered it a little, given it some potency. If Ty wears it, it should shield him from any side effects of being bound to the dead. And it should sustain you a little. It should ease some of the strangeness of being in the living world. You can touch it. And two, should you or he feel the need of help, you can use it to call on me, or Ty can. Once it belonged to Kit's mother. It was given to her by Tessa and Jem, so that when she was in danger she could summon them. Now it will serve you and your brother.
Livy stretched out a finger, stroked the silver heron. Oh, she said. I can feel it.
Magnus said, yes.
Well, good. Like one of Ty's fidget toys, Livy said. Like Julian's lighter. She was running her fingers along the chain now. Is the baby okay, Mina?
Yes, Magnus said. She's fine. Everyone is fine. The conservatory, on the other hand.
Livy thought suddenly of Demet Tarn. She said, You've been here before. To the Scholomance.
Yes, Magnus said. Many times over the years.
Have you ever been to Demet Tarn? Livy said.
Yes, Magnus said. A most unimpressive body of water. You must find it a sad change from the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, well, there are stories that it's supernatural in some way, Livy said. But nobody knows how. Ty and I were trying to see if we could find out anything about it.
Magnus said. Let me see. There were stories about it, but I never paid much attention to them. What was it?
He sat in silence for a minute, and Livy sat companionably with him. Ty stirred as if he were dreaming in a way that made Livy think that he would wake up soon.
Yes, Magnus said, of course. The story was this, that if you went to Demet Tarn and looked into the water for long enough, you would see something of your future. That was the enchantment placed on it by some warlock or other. Funnily enough, I believe he was from Devon, actually. Dimmit is a Welsh word.
Why?
Did you go there? Livy, did you see something there?
No, Livy said at last. She tried to think of what it had been like, sinking into that vast dark nothingness. I didn't see anything. It was nothing at all.
I see, Magnus said in a tone that suggested he saw everything she wasn't saying. But let us say that there was someone who happened to look into the dismal Demet Tarn. And let's say they saw something they didn't like. Something that suggested a future they didn't want. And let's say this someone came and talked to me. Do you know what I would tell them?
What? Livy said.
Magnus said. I would tell them this. The future isn't fixed. If we see a path in front of us that we would not choose, then we choose another path. Another future. Demet Tarn be damned. Wouldn't you agree with that, Livy?
He stared hard at Livy, and Livy stared right back. She couldn't think of anything to say at all, but finally she set her mouth and nodded. From the bed, Ty said, Livy. His eyes opened and found her, and he said, Livy, again. This time he didn't sound despairing. He hadn't noticed yet that Magnus was there at all.
A terrible wailing came from the doorway as Ty spoke. It was Irene. Her whiskery jaws stretched open and all of her fur standing on end. Livy would not have thought that such a tiny animal could have produced such a large noise. Still wailing, Irene leaped onto the bed and butted Ty in the chin. The noise she was making changed to smaller, angry, inquiring trills, like a hot tea kettle who had a lot of questions but suspected she wasn't going to like any of the answers.
"What on earth is that?" Magnus said.
"This is Irene," Ty said. "She's a Carpathian lynx."
"Of course," said Magnus. "A Carpathian lynx, how silly of me." His eyes met Livy's. "A boy, a Carpathian lynx, and a ghost. Truly, I expect great things from you and your brother, Livy. Here, Ty, this is for you."
He dropped the Herondale necklace into Ty's palm.
"Livy will explain its purpose. Suffice it to say that if you need me for any reason at all, you can use it to summon me. Livy's been telling me about Idris, about what she overheard. But I've been up all night long, and I need some strong tea. I'm going to go find Ragnar Fell and make him find me some strong tea."
He made as grand an exit as anyone could make when they were wearing an oversized down coat, and as he exited, Anoush entered, his arms bloody with scratches. Anoush gazed after Magnus in astonishment.
"That was Magnus Bane," he said to Ty. "He was here to see you?"
"Yes, he's our friend," Ty said.
Anoush said, "I knew that you knew him, but I didn't realize you had a just dropping by the Skolomance to see you type of relationship. Sorry about that animal. I went to your room to see if I could bring you back a book or some clothes or something, and she got away from me. She's so pretty, but she's so mean."
"Her name is Irene," Ty said, looking fondly at the lynx curled up beside him. Anoush said,
"Again, rhymes with mean. Do you want me to go get some scraps from the kitchen for her?"
When Anoush was gone, Livy told Ty everything that had happened while she had been in Los Angeles and in the conservatory in England. Ty said, "I'm so sorry, Livy." "For what?" she said. "For doing this to you," he said. "Oh, Ty," she said, "I would have done it for you. It isn't a thing that should be done, but I would have done it anyway. And so we'd be in just the same mess we're in now. Besides, I think I'm getting the hang of this ghost thing." Ty nodded. He turned the necklace over and over in his hand and then held it out, dangling the heron over the bed so that the sunlight caught the silver, and Irene batted it with her paw. Livy thought of Kit sitting at the table in the kitchen, so carefully not asking her anything about Ty. She reached over and caught the chain in her hand, gently entangling it from Irene's sharp claws. Holding the necklace still, Livy said,
"This belonged to Kit. You'll have to write him, to say thank you. You'll write him and give the letter to Magnus to take back when he goes."
"Okay," Ty said at last. "But he won't write back."
"Then you'll keep on writing until he does," Livy said. "Necromancy is bad. We're all agreed on that. But postcards are pretty harmless, you know? Something scenic on the front." Dimet Tarn flashed in front of her. That black nothingness. "Wish you were here." That kind of thing. She held the chain tighter, rubbed the small links between her fingers. Maybe that was her future. Black nothingness. But right now she had Ty. She could choose the path that led away from Dimet Tarn for as long as she could. She had an anchor. She would hold on as tightly as she could.
Forever Fallen.
Awake, arise, or be forever fallen. Milton. New York, 2013. Jem Carstairs and Kit Herondale came through the portal together, from the black midnight velvet of the English woods into the orange-starred deep blue of a New York street in the evening. Kit eyed the silver stream of honking cars with the same expression he'd worn since Jem suggested going, a mixture of excitement and nerves.
They didn't, exactly welcome me at the L.A. Shadow Market the last few times I went, Kit said. You're sure this will be okay?
I am, Jem assured him.
The yellow and red lights of cars played over the intricate scrollwork and arched windows of the abandoned theater. The Shadow Market on Canal Street was much like he remembered it from a decade ago and more, though Jem himself was so different. To a mundane, steel shutters and boards covered the entrance. To Jem and Kit, they were silver and wood beads, a curtain that chimed a song as they passed through. A warlock woman paused when she saw them.
Hello, Hypatia, said Jem.
I think you know Kit.
I know that two shadow hunters make even more trouble than one, said Hypatia.
She rolled her starry eyes and passed on, but a werewolf Jem knew from the Paris Shadow Market stopped and chatted with them for a moment. He said it was a pleasure to meet Kit, and always a pleasure to see Jem.
Congratulations, by the way, he added. Jem glowed. Thank you.
Jem had been surprised to find that he was welcome in most shadow markets now. He had been to many over the years, and quite a few of the vendors in attendance were immortal. People remembered him, and after a time they had stopped fearing him. He hadn't even realized it, but he had become a familiar sight, his visits marking a market night as lucky. He was the only Silent Brother most of them had ever seen. The first time he'd gone to a shadow market once he was no longer a Silent Brother, hand in hand with a warlock woman, seemed to confirm the shadow market people's opinion that he was close to being one of their own. Showing up with Kit, who had basically grown up in the shadow market in Los Angeles, pretty much cemented that.
You see? Jem murmured. No problem.
Kit's shoulders were relaxing and his blue eyes beginning to shine with a familiar wicked gleam. He pointed out several interesting features of the market that Jem was already aware of, a market boy showing off, and Jem smiled and encouraged him to keep talking.
They do it with magic mirrors, Kit whispered in Jem's ear when they stopped to see two mermaids doing tricks in a tank.
The mermaid glared at Kit, and Kit laughed. They stopped at a stall to buy candied moonflowers, since Kit had a fiendish sweet tooth.
I know you, said the fairy vendor. Aren't you Johnny Rook's boy?
Kit's smile died a swift death.
Not anymore. Whose are you now?
Nobody's, Kit answered quietly. The fairy vendor blinked, a second eyelid sliding in sideways and making the blink rather impressive. Jem reached out to touch Kit's shoulder, but Kit was already moving on, browsing the sweets as if he found them deeply fascinating. Jem cleared his throat.
I hear there is a special stall run by warlocks and fairies offering potions and illusions. My friend Shade told me of it.
She nodded understanding and leaned down to whisper in his ear. The stall devoted to the fairy and warlock joint venture was a carved wooden caravan parked in the antechamber of the Canal Street building. The caravan was painted bright blue and adorned with paintings that moved. As Jem and Kit approached, birds took flight from several gilded cages and soared free over the bright blue painted sky. The fairy woman had mushrooms growing in her hair and ribbons looped around them. She seemed very young and enthusiastic about selling Jem the medicine he asked for. Jem lifted the porcelain lid to examine its contents carefully and apologized for doing so. She waved this off.
Perfectly understandable, considering what it's for. Lovely to meet you properly at last. Any friend of Shade's. Such a distinguished gentleman. Perhaps it's the Irish in me, but I do love a fellow in green.
Kit became overwhelmed by a fit of coughing. Jem smiled discreetly and patted them on the back.
Also, the fairy said in a rush, I saw you once about 8 years ago, when you were still. I only got one glimpse, but you seemed so hauntingly sad and so hauntingly attractive.
Thank you, said Jem. I'm very happy now. Your cough seems to be getting worse, Kit. Do you need medicine as well?
Kit straightened up.
No, I'm good. Come on, brother, hauntingly attractive.
There's no need to mention this to Tessa.
And yet, said Kit, I'm gonna.
Congratulations, the fairy woman yelled after Jem.
All of his knowledge as a silent brother told him the potion was harmless and would do its work. Jem offered another smile over his shoulder to the woman and let Kit pull him towards the row of stalls in the next room across the way. The market was growing more crowded, so crowded that all the fairies who could take wing were flying overhead. One was being pursued by a werewolf who was yelling that the fairy had unfairly snatched the last hat in her size. The fleeing fairy's winged shadow darkened a golden head and broad shoulders that struck Jem as familiar.
Isn't that Jace? I think that's...
Jem began, turning to Kit. Then he saw Kit's face was white. Kit was staring over at a tall boy with dark hair and headphones, browsing through a stall and running his fingers through the dried herbs. Jem laid his hand on Kit's shoulder. Kit seemed oblivious, rooted to the spot, until the boy turned around and had blue eyes and a crooked nose and was not Ty Blackthorn. "I have what we came for," Jem said. He spoke with his usual and carefully cultivated calm. "Shall we go, or do you want to look around? We can do whatever you want." Kit's jaw was still set. Jem knew that look. Herondales were always flames, he thought. They loved and suffered as if they would burn away with the sheer force of their own fire.
"Let's go home," Kit mumbled.
In spite of his slight disappointment, Jem found himself smiling. It was the first time Kit had called their house that. The man who had never had the chance to be Jace Herondale, and who was no longer Jace at all, was starting to think that coming here had been a bad idea. The Seelie Queen had been the one to insist he should have a new name, when he made his way to Faerie, wanting protection for Ash and help with his plans. The Queen had answered all his questions about Clary, but her help hadn't come free. Royalty tended to make demands.
"I'm accustomed to the other Jace," she said with a regal sneer. "Though I admit, not overly fond, what else can we call you?"
Jonathan, he thought first, and flinched at even the thought of that name which had surprised him. He hadn't done much flinching in Thule. "Janice," he told the Queen. The guard with two faces, the guard of endings and beginnings and passages between strange doorways.
"The god?" the Queen repeated.
"My father gave me a classical education," Janice told her, "to go with my classical good looks." That had made the Queen laugh.
"I see some things do not change, no matter the world."
She saw nothing. Nobody in this world could know what he had been forced to become. It was in Faerie that Janice had heard of the fairy and warlock stall and the magic it could do, and he hadn't been able to resist. He knew Shadowhunters were not welcome at Shadow Markets. He thought that if he wore a hood and a cloak, the risk would be minimal. Unfortunately, several people were looking at him as if they recognized him. Well, let them think that the Jace of this world made a regular practice of haunting the Shadow Market. He had nothing invested in protecting that Jace's reputation. Janice turned. A werewolf slammed into him and cursed.
"Hey, Shadowhunter, watch where you're going."
Janice had his hand on his dagger when another werewolf came by and slapped the first werewolf upside the head.
"Do you know who you're talking to?" he demanded. "That's Jace Herondale, the head of the Institute."
The werewolf paled.
"Oh my god, I'm so sorry, I didn't know. Please forgive him. He's from a horrible desert wasteland and he doesn't know what's going on," said the other werewolf.
"I'm from Ohio."
"That's what I said."
The two werewolves gazed at Janice in apologetic misery. Janice was very confused, but he slowly let go of the hilt of his dagger. This pair might be more useful alive.
"So sorry," the second werewolf stressed.
"It's..." Janice cleared his throat. "It's fine."
"He's also the consul's parapetai," said the werewolf. "You know, Alec Lightwood."
Janice felt something twist deep in his gut. The sensation surprised him. He was used to feeling nothing at all. He held the thought of Alec being consul in front of his mental eye, like a peculiar stone he was studying. He'd heard from the Queen that in this new, strange world everything was different and everyone was alive. But when he'd imagined those he'd known once alive again, he'd imagined them unchanged. Alec as consul. He couldn't imagine it.
"I'm actually here on
A secret mission, he said. I'd appreciate it if you kept quiet about seeing me. I thought so, said the second werewolf. Cloak, hood, secret mission, I said to myself.
Janice's smile became less real and far more easy. I can tell you're perceptive. Perhaps in the future, if I needed your help.
Anything we can do, the werewolves rushed to assure him. Absolutely anything.
Janice kept smiling. Oh, good. It was good to make allies, especially those who were stupid and eager to please. Janice headed to what he had come for, the bright blue caravan where he had been assured that fairies and warlocks together could produce impenetrable glamours. In Thul, there was no more warlock magic. There were no more warlocks at all. But there were demons crawling everywhere across the surface of that world, thick as flies on spoiled meat, and Sebastian could make the demons create illusions. Very occasionally, when Janice had pleased Sebastian, he would give him such a gift. Only sometimes, and it was never enough. A fairy with mushrooms in her hair led him into the caravan. She seemed young, and she quailed when his eyes fell on her, but he paid the price she and the warlock demanded. It was exorbitant. He would have paid more. The inside of the caravan was a wooden shell that had a jewel hidden within. The fairies had not been wrong when they said the combined magic could produce an extraordinary result. She was the most convincing illusion he had ever seen. She was small, always so small. Her hair fell in red loops and swirls around her face and her shoulders. He had wanted to follow every loop with his finger, work out the precise shape of each curl, as he'd wanted to trace connections between every golden freckle. He'd wanted to know her completely. Clary, he said. Her name sounded foreign in his mouth. He hadn't said it often, even in Thul, where whatever he felt had been buried under layers and layers of a weight like cement. Come here, he said. He was surprised by the roughness in his own voice. His hands were shaking. It felt like a distant, even despicable weakness.
She moved towards him. He caught her by the wrists and pulled her roughly against his chest. Holding her was a mistake. That was where the illusion began to collapse. He could feel her trembling, and Clary would not have done that. Clary was the bravest person he knew. The illusions were never convincing enough. No illusion could love you back. No illusion would ever look at him the way Clary had once looked at him. And though he didn't know why he needed that, he did. He had needed it before, and the severing of his bond with Sebastian had made it 1,000 times worse.
Clary, Clary, Clary.
He fooled himself for another moment, pressing his lips against her forehead, then her cheek, then burying his face in the cloud of her bright hair. Oh, my darling, he murmured, reaching for his knife as her eyes widened in realization and fear. My darling, why did you have to die? Kit ran up the stone steps to his room, slamming the door behind him, as soon as they returned to Sirenworth Hall. Jem thought it might be best to give him privacy for a little while. He was still slightly worried as he climbed the steps himself, following the sound of a song echoing off the slate walls. Black for hunting through the night, for death and mourning the colours white, gold for a bride in her wedding gown, and red to call enchantment down. Saffron lights the victory march, green will mend our broken hearts, silver for the demon towers, and bronze to summon wicked powers. It was a variation on an ancient shadow hunter song. Jem could not have guessed how old. His father had sung it to him when he was a child. When he pushed open the door, the world narrowed down for a moment to a single room, and that room was full of soft light. There was a cluster of shining witch lights arranged in the old-fashioned iron grate, and pearlescent rays caught in Tessa's brown curls as she bent over the cradle, rocking it gently. The cradle had been carved more than 100 years ago from an oak felled in these woods. Jem had seen it made, with careful hands and patient love. The cradle rocked just as smoothly now as it had then.
plaintive grizzling drifted from the cradle, and Jem leaned over to see its occupant. She lay on soft white bedding, piles and piles of fleeciness, so it seemed she slept on a cloud. Her shock of hair was very black against the sheets, and her small face was screwed up in outraged distress. Wilhelmina, Yichanka, Carstairs. For their lost Will, the first and only possible name. And Wild Rose, because all those who Jem loved best grew in beautiful rebellion. He'd wanted a Chinese name for his darling, and wanted to commemorate lost Rosemary, who had trusted Jem and Tessa with what was infinitely precious to her and was now infinitely precious to him. Rosemary had trusted him with Kit. Rosemary was the herb meant for remembrance, and Zachariah meant remember. The longer Jem lived, the more surely he believed that life was a wheel coming full circle and bringing you to those you were meant to love. She had an imposing name, their little one, and it might have been longer had they included Grey, but Tessa said that warlocks chose their own name if she chose to be a warlock. Mina might choose to be a shadow hunter. She might be anything she pleased. She was everything already. Jem was often lost in admiring her, but he did not let himself do so for long tonight. Instead, he lifted her in his arms. Her hands flew out like startled starfish and came to rest, the smallest, tenderest weights against his collarbone. Mina's dark eyes popped open all the way and she went quiet.
"Oh, I see how it is,"
Jem's wife whispered, laughing softly.
"Daddy's girl."
"She knows I brought her something from the market," said Jem, and gently rubbed the fairy salve on Mina's soft pink gums. Mina wriggled and fussed as he did so, kicking her legs as if she were swimming in a race. But when Jem was finished, the salve seemed to do its work quickly. Then she settled, her small face bewildered but happy, as if Jem had performed some peculiar and marvellous feat. Tessa said it was early for a baby to start teething. Mina was remarkable in advance in all sorts of ways, Jem considered proudly.
"Chin-jin," Jem murmured to her. "You are more like your mother every day."
She was very like Tessa. Whenever he pointed this out, Tessa and Kit seemed skeptical.
"I mean, she's a baby, so she mostly looks like a kind of screwed-up turnip," said Kit. "In a good way. But if she looks like anyone..."
Kit had shrugged. Tessa had the same expression on her face now as Kit had worn then.
"Still, no," Tessa informed him. "She looks just like you."
Jem lifted Mina up towards the witchlights, one hand cupped protectively around the fragile curve of her head. Happiness came easily to Mina. She crowed with delight, witchlight radiant around her ruffled cap of black hair and her round waving arms. And he was dazzled and overwhelmed by the sheer immensity of his good fortune.
"But she's so beautiful," Jem said helplessly. "And where might she get that from?"
"I love you forever, James Carstairs," said Tessa, leaning her dear head against his shoulder. "But you are a fool."
Jem drew Mina back in and held her close, and she nuzzled her dimpled cheek against his, burbling to him joyfully. From the day she was born, Mina had gurgled at ceilings and walls and into the tiny caves of her cupped hands. Her gurgling grew higher pitched and more excited when she was in Tessa's or Jem's arms, trying to attract their attention. She talked in her sleep, as her mother did. She was always talking, and Jem was always listening, and soon he would understand every word. Their daughter was so like Tessa. Jem knew what he knew. Janus zipped his jacket up to hide the blood as he passed a fairy stall. He decided he'd risked his luck long enough and he should make his way home.
"Yo, Jason!"
called a black-haired vampire girl in a blue mini-dress. She was looking at him expectantly, but from what she called him, she couldn't know him that well. "Actually, it's Jace," said Janus casually, still moving for the exit. He didn't understand what he'd said wrong, but he understood it had been something. Instant alarm flashed across her face and she darted away through the crowd, making it out of the market, but even a vampire
wasn't faster than Janice. Nobody was. He cornered her in an alleyway, backhanding her when she fought, pinning her thrashing limbs. He got his dagger to her throat, but she didn't stop struggling.
You're not Jace, said the vampire girl. What are you? Eidolon? Shapeshifter? Herondale cosplayer?
She squinted at him. He was going to have to break her neck, he realized. Tedious. Vampires were hard to kill, but he was still stronger than they were. I am Jace Herondale, he told her. It was a relief to say it to someone, even someone who was going to die. A stronger, better Jace Herondale than you have in this world. Not that you'll understand a word I say. He reached for her throat, but she was staring at him with a look of realization.
You're from Thule, she said. Alec told me about this freaky other world where Clary died and everything was screwed literally to hell. And Jace was bound to Sebastian Morgenstern. You're that, Jace.
She glared up at him defiantly, and something about her face rang a dull, funereal bell. I know who you are too, Janice said slowly. You're Lily Chen. In my world, Sebastian killed you.
He did?
Lily looked outraged.
What the hell with that guy? Irony intended.
You're the girl Raphael Santiago started a war for. Lily abruptly and entirely ceased fighting. It was startling enough that Janice almost let go, but his father had trained him to be remorseless.
What?
Her voice trembled.
Raphael?
When Sebastian was taking over, Janice said slowly, lost to memory, to the time when Clary fell and the world broke. The warlocks were gone. The fairies were with us. Sebastian asked the vampires and the werewolves to join him. Most of the vampires left were rounded up by Raphael Santiago, the head of the New York vampire clan, and Sebastian was in talks with him. Raphael was not pleased by what had happened to the warlocks, but he said he was the practical type. He wanted protection for his vampires. We thought we might be able to come to an arrangement. Only Sebastian found out you were sending secret information to a werewolf girl. He asked if you wanted to have fun with him, and you said you did. Janice was surprised he even remembered that time. He'd been blind with pain back then, before Sebastian made him stop thinking of Clary so often. Sebastian had said he was pathetic and useless and feeling, so he made it stop. I wish I could resist killer parties, said Lily. But I can't. This is a fully plausible scenario. Her voice was almost absent-minded. Her eyes were searching Janice's face. Sebastian killed you and showed Raphael what was left. Raphael said you were stupid and it served you right. 6 hours later, he led every vampire he could and some of the werewolves out of the talks. He set the building on fire as he went. I had to pull Sebastian out from the burning rubble. Next we heard, Raphael's with Livia Blackthorne and the Resistance.
He's alive? Lily's voice was sharp. In your stupid messed up world, Raphael's alive?
The words burst out of her mouth.
Take me to him.
Even though Janice had been expecting it, the words were shocking. So shocking that the truth fell from his own mouth without him meaning to say it. There isn't any hope for that world. Even the sun has been blotted out. His head ached as soon as he spoke. The pain felt like Sebastian being displeased with him even now.
Then bring him here, said Lily. Please, go back and bring him here.
Her hands were no longer shoving at him, but clinging to him, almost pleading. If I did, Janice ground out, what would you do for me? He saw her mind working. Behind her watchful black eyes. She wasn't stupid, this vampire girl.
Depends, she snapped. What are you going to ask me for?
Let's be clear, Janice said. You'd do anything for this. The vampire girl's sharp face softened. She liked Jace, Janice realized. She trusted him. Some part of her still thought Janice was her friend. She was underestimating him. Not on guard as she should be. She didn't really think he would hurt her.
I guess so, she said. I guess I would.
She leaned back against the alley wall,
Would it help if I told you you were still hot?
Probably not, Jonas said.
Don't repeat that to the other Jace, said Lily. He shouldn't be encouraged.
You know, I think some people might find you more hot. Little less of a pretty boy, little more rugged thing going on. It's a trade-off.
Most things are, Jonas agreed.
I'm not hitting on you, by the way. I'm just making observations here.
Jonas shrugged. Wouldn't do you any good if you were.
Still a one-woman man, huh?
Still, Jonas said very quietly.
Lily was gazing at him as if she was sorry for him. As if she could know how he felt. He wanted to put out her eyes, to stop her looking at him like that. But she might be useful.
Let's make a bargain, Jonas suggested. You do me one favor when the time comes without asking questions, and I will do what I can to bring Raphael to your world. It isn't going to be easy, and it will take time. You don't tell anyone you've seen me. If you do, I can always send a message back to Thule, telling them to kill Raphael. She winced. Do we have a deal? Jonas said.
There was a long silence. Jonas could still hear the songs and bells of the Shadow Market flowing on past this dark alley with the undead. Then Lily said,
We have a deal.
He let Lily leave and followed her quietly. He saw her take out her phone as if she might call somebody and warn them. But she didn't. She put her phone back in her pocket.
It was almost funny.
Jonas knew no way back into that other world. But it didn't matter if this girl was smart or if she wanted to be good because she was wild and clawing and frantic to believe him. Hope made everybody a fool. To make people obey, all you had to do was first make sure they were desperate. Jonas should know that well enough. He'd been desperate for years.
Don't repeat that to the other Jace, Lily had said.
As if Jonas was planning to have any conversations with the other Jace, the one from this world, the one who'd gotten lucky. Jonas didn't need to talk to him. Jonas would learn everything he had to know about this world so he could pass himself off as the other Jace. Then he would kill this world's version of himself and take his place, beside Clary. It was near dawn when Mina woke crying. Tessa stirred, but Jem dropped a kiss on her bare shoulder and murmured, I'll go, love. Tessa had suffered pains that Jem could not bring in Mina into the world. His wife would never lose sleep with the baby while Jem was in the house. That was Jem's privilege. Jem crept up to Mina's room, quiet so as not to wake Kit, and to let Tessa go back to sleep. When he reached her room, though, he saw Kit was awake. Kit was already in the baby's room, with Mina in his arms.
Hey, Kit said to the baby, speaking seriously as if to a teammate. Come on, do me a solid, will you, Min? You've been waking them up all week. I bet they're tired.
Mina's small face was tear-stained, but she had clearly forgotten her tears before they were dry. She was smiling a gummy smile, apparently enchanted by this new experience.
Jem always talks about how advanced you are. So, how about advancing to the part where you sleep through the night? Kit said.
I wonder if having a mom who is an immortal warlock means that you've been maturing faster than other babies. Mina had no response for this. Kit didn't hold Mina often, though he would bend over the cradle or someone else's arms and awkwardly offer her attention when he came into the room where she was. He did give her his forefinger to hold frequently. And now that Mina could focus better, she would hold her hands out imperiously when Kit came near. Jem was sure she knew Min Min was Kit's name for her, and Kit was the boy who held her hand. Now she was bundled inelegantly in Kit's arms, the long white woolen blanket Katerina Loss had knitted for her trailing. Kit tripped over it as he walked the floor and stumbled. Jem tensed to lunge across the room and catch them. But Kit caught himself against the wall, though he let out a curse as he did so and promptly looked horrified and belatedly tried to cover one of Mina's ears.
Please don't tell Jem and Tessa I said that word in front of you, Kit exclaimed.
Mina, who clearly thought Kit was playing a game with her,
gave him another sleepy smile that split her small face, then yawned like a kitten. Kit bit his lip and hummed a broken line of a song to her, several times over. Soon she was drooling against Kit's t-shirt, which had a design on it that Kit had informed Jem meant superheroes. Kit patted her on the back.
"There we go," Kit murmured, sounding proud of himself. "It's our secret."
Jem watched Kit and Mina for a little while longer, then crept back to his room, letting Kit return to his own bed, believing he'd help Jem and Tessa to rest. Janice kept thinking of that word, console, and Alec, and he decided he should survey the situation for himself. He couldn't pass himself off as Alec's parabatai if he didn't know about Alec's life. His father had always said that knowledge was power to be used in battle. It was too dangerous to go to the Institute and risk someone seeing him, but Janice remembered where Magnus's loft had been. He concealed himself and watched the door until Alec emerged. It was one of the sunny spring days in New York that was better than summer, the sky full of clear light and soft breezes. Alec was where Alec had always wanted to be, walking easily by Magnus's side. There were two children with them. One had very dark, short, crisply curling hair, and even though he was too young to bear marks, there was still a suggestion of grace about him that said Shadow Hunter. His small fingers were curled securely within one of Magnus's ringed hands. Magnus's other hand was tucked, with Alex, in the pocket of Alec's ratty, unzipped hoodie. The other kid was glamoured to look like a mundane, but Janice saw beneath it to blue skin and horns. The warlock boy was up on Alec's shoulders, laughing and kicking his feet against Alec's chest. It took Janice a moment to realize the strangest thing. Alec's chest and shoulders were broader than they had been in his world. Alec had died when he was still a boy, always a little afraid to be in love. "Console," thought Janice. "You must be so proud." Janice followed as they made their way to the Brooklyn Botanical Garden, where the cherry trees were blooming. Alec and Magnus seemed to be taking these kids to the Cherry Blossom Festival. The kids were excited. The pink clusters of flowers formed a soft avenue around them, a pink marble arch come alive, petals falling like bright confetti into their hair. The little boy on Alec's shoulders caught the petals in his hand. The trees provided plenty of cover so that Janice would not be seen. There were taiko drummers under a bandstand, and people dancing in the grass. Alec set the warlock child down, and he immediately ran into the crowd of dancers and began to strike dramatic poses. Magnus went and danced with the little kid, though Magnus's dancing did not involve any falling on his butt. The Shadow Hunter boy copied Alec, leaning against a tree with his arms folded in the same way Alec's were, until Magnus beckoned and said, "Rafe!" And the boy's small, surly face lit up and he ran to him. Then he held Magnus's hands and let Magnus pirouette him about, his shoes lighting up as he twirled in the dust. Alec watched them for a while, fondly, then wandered away to buy ice creams. A couple of downworlder teens, a young werewolf girl and a fairy boy, were waiting in line and watched him come with nervous delight.
"It's our console," said the werewolf girl.
"He's not technically ours," said the fairy boy. "He belongs to the Shadow Hunters who aren't our souls. Maya is your leader and King Kieran is mine."
"I can have a console as well as a pack leader if I want," muttered the werewolf. "He's coming right over. What do we say?"
"I cannot lie, Michelle," said the fairy. "You know this. You have to pretend to be cool for both of us."
Alec nodded to them, a little strained with strangers still, but trying to be friendly in a way that Alec Janice had known might not have. Alec smiled quickly into their silence and offered,
"Hey, here for the festival?"
The fairy boy gasped out,
"Yes."
"Me too," said Alec.
"Family outing. Those are my kids, over there, with my husband." "Over there, that's my husband,"
Alec said, "my husband," so proudly, as if the word was a new and dearly prized acquisition with a shine still on it, something he wanted to show everybody.
"My boyfriend," Clary had called Janice a few times, and it made him so happy to finally be hers, to think she might be proud he was hers. He'd been embarrassed to show how happy he was. He remembered the emotions now, and they prickled like pins and needles, like dead limbs starved the blood finally beginning to wake up. And like pins and needles, they hurt.
"Oh, congratulations,"
Michelle the werewolf said to Alec, looking as if she might cry.
"Your husband? That's so nice."
The boy nodded vigorously.
Thanks, said Alec. "Nice to meet you. Enjoy the festival."
He went back to his family, where the kids hailed the ice creams with great joy. Alec slid his arms around Magnus, and they danced a little together. Alec slightly clumsy in a dance, as he never was in battle, but smiling, with his eyes shut and his cheek laid against Magnus's. The young couple wandered off with their ice creams, which were decorated with rose petals, and which the fairy seemed to enjoy more than his girlfriend, chattering excitedly about the amazing experience they'd just had. Janice watched them, and when they wandered off among the trees for privacy, he let them see him.
"You're Jace Herondale,"
breathed the werewolf girl, obviously thrilled.
"Jace Herondale and Alec Lightwood. This is literally the best day of my life. I can't wait to tell Mom."
"Actually," said Janice, "I'd appreciate it if you didn't tell anybody. You two are around the same age my friends and I were when we saved the world. I think I can trust you two. I think you could do great things. I'd love your help." They looked at each other with awkward, surprised enthusiasm.
"Help with what?" said the werewolf.
Janice told them. It seemed to go well at first. Their eyes were shining. They wanted so badly to be heroes. He wanted to be one himself, once. The werewolf girl, who seemed to know more of Alec and Jace in this world, was nodding eagerly. The fairy boy nodded less and said very little. Janice wasn't certain of him. After he was done talking and pretended to leave, Janice swung around and quietly followed them. He could feel his soundless rune sparking against his skin. A novel sensation after so long.
"I don't care who he is," said the fairy boy. "I don't trust him. I'm going to tell the king."
Well, win some, lose some. The important thing was knowing when to cut your losses. Janice cut their throats and buried the two young lovers side by side under the green leaves of the springtime trees. He made sure to close their eyes and clasp the girl's hand safe in the boy's before he smoothed the soil over them, so they were sleeping peacefully together. He gave them the death he would have wanted for himself. Mina woke early in the morning. This time Jem got to her first, before Kit or Tessa had a chance to stir. Mina smiled with surprised delight when she saw Jem's face over the side of the crib, as if she'd worried that this time he wouldn't come. "There is never any need to worry, Mina mine," said Jem. "Silly melon." He dressed her in the red romper with a blue rabbit on the front that Magnus had sent them, then put her in his front pack. Mina cooed excitedly as he did so. She loved an outing. They walked together through the woods to the village. The village was very small, and there was a great bakery they often patronized. The two ladies who ran the bakery were very welcoming.
"Oh, look,"
he heard one of the ladies whisper to the other, quietly enough so he wouldn't have heard them if he did not still have Shadow Hunter hearing.
"He brought the baby again."
Jem bought pain au chocolat for Kit, because he liked it, and apple and raisin pastries for Tessa. "My wife doesn't like chocolate," he explained. But Kit does."
"Right, your wife's nephew?"
The woman's tone was friendly as well as curious. "Nephew, cousin," Jem shrugged. "Same family. We were very glad when he agreed to come live with us." The woman winked.
"My little sister says he's a total beast."
Jem didn't think that was a very nice thing to say about Kit.
"You guys seem like such a happy couple," the woman continued, which was nice. "Have you been together long?"
"We've only been married a few years,"
said Jem. But we've had a very long engagement. He accepted the paper bag of pastries with a smile and waved Mina's dimpled hand at them. Say bye to the ladies, Mina.
So cute,
he heard the woman whisper as the door of the bakery closed behind them.
I'm dying.
Hear that, Mina mine? Jem murmured. They think you're cute. They're right, of course. Mina waved at the trees in loose, uncoordinated movements, like a tiny queen accepting tribute. He took the long way through the woods, past the thatched pub where they had afternoon tea sometimes, and across the bridge so Mina could babble to the brook. Through the shifting green leaves and radiant splashes of sunlight, Jem saw the slate roof and uneven white plaster of the small manor house that was their home. This house, nestled on the edge of Dartmoor, had been in the Carstairs family for a long time. Jem's uncle Elias Carstairs had owned it once and lived there with his family. Out of concern for Kit, Jem and Tessa had enlisted Magnus to put up wards around the house that prevented those with ill intentions from crossing onto the property. At the side of the house, blue shuttered French doors hung open, showing a white painted kitchen splashed with sunlight. Jem's family was having breakfast at a massive farmer's table. Tessa was in a white robe, and Kit was still in his superhero pajamas, and they hailed the coming of pastries with acclaim. Mina and I journeyed far, and have returned bearing love and baked goods.
My adventurous Mina, said Tessa, kissing Mina's silky hair and tipping up her face for Jem's kiss. Are you ready to defeat evil vampires using your knowledge of technology and the train timetables, like in Dracula?
Saw that movie, said Kit.
Read that book, Tessa shot back.
I have no idea what you two are talking about, Jem said on cue. But Mina was much admired in town. Tessa raised an eyebrow.
I'm sure she was.
But one of the lady's sisters was unkind about Kit. Don't make friends with her, Kit. She called you a beast.
Kit beamed. Really? Did someone really say that? Who said that?
Oh, is that good? Asked Jem.
I have been working out, said Kit happily to himself.
I didn't know that was good either, Tessa confided to Jem.
Language changes so often through the years it's hard to keep track of, especially slang. It's fascinating, but sometimes I like the earlier meanings of the words best.
Yeah, well, men has to know how people speak in this day and age, Kit said sternly.
Mina cooed and reached out her hands to him, and Kit surrendered his forefinger to her grasp. He continued to eat pain au chocolat with his free hand.
You want the other kids to think you're cool, right, Min?
He asked her as she burbled agreement.
You're lucky I'm here.
Tessa swooped on Kit from behind, ruffling his golden hair with the hand not holding a pastry, on her way to get Jem coffee from the stove.
We're all lucky you're here, she told him.
Kit bowed his head, but not before Jem saw his face flush, pleased and shy. Once he buried the kids, Janice went back and found Magnus and Alec had wandered in the opposite direction, farther afield from the music. Alec and the kids were playing soccer with a fluorescent pink ball. Alec, being Alec, was half playing, half patiently teaching them. Janice remembered when they were kids, how whenever he or Isabel wasn't as good as Alec was, Alec would practice with them endlessly until they were better than Alec was himself. Every time he would do that. Janice had forgotten until now. The Shadowhunter boy was good at soccer when he was concentrating, but he was constantly abandoning the game and zigzagging back to Magnus, hovering by his side like an adoring bumblebee. Janice envisioned what Magnus had become in his world, the pitiful thing his body had been. It was odd to see Magnus whole and well, sitting under a cherry blossom tree. He was wearing buckled purple boots, skinny jeans, and a tank top